when I first began treating people with panic disorder, I explained to them, this is a mental disorder, you know, it's not your fault, and we can help you with medications and behavior therapy. And they consistently said, it feels to me like it's my heart, doctor. Can you refer me to a cardiologist? Gradually, I took a systematic evolutionary view, and I started framing it for my patients in terms of what it's for. And then I began telling my patients, you know what? You're having emergency responses that are false alarms. It's just like the smoke detector going off when there's not really a fire, that's just burnt toast. But your inner mind doesn't know that. And so you feel terrible and you get the sweating, your heart starts pounding. All those things would be useful if you were in a life-threatening emergency. But for you, it's a false alarm. And by the way, it's fortunate that you have the capacity for that. There are other people who never experience enough anxiety, and that could be a fatal disorder. Yours is just miserable. And then I explained to them how, in fact, we can use this understanding of anxiety to appropriately apply psychotherapy and behavior therapy and medications to get them over their problem. It really helps people a lot. In fact, about a quarter of people I talked with, I gave them the explanation for what a panic attack is. And they said, oh, so I'm not going to die of a heart attack. It's not a stroke. It's not epilepsy. I'm just not going to worry about it anymore. And that was all they needed.
Hey there. Welcome to the Happy Habit Podcast once more. I'm your host, Matthew. We like to talk health and well-being here every Monday and Thursday. Thank you so much for stopping by. If you're not aware, we are now on YouTube and on Instagram if you want to check out the videos for these episodes. And if you're enjoying the series, please like, subscribe, share, and leave the podcast a positive review. If all that means just giving us a 3, 4, or 5 stars, but only if you think we have earned it. Today, I am talking with one of the pioneers of evolutionary medicine and evolutionary psychiatry, Professor Randolph Nesse. In this episode, we discuss what evolution has to do with modern-day psychiatry and how knowledge of evolution's influences on someone's mental health informs Professor Nesse's ability to help his patients. We learn whether our quest for happiness is merely a distraction. Is mental illness a result of nature or nurture, or indeed a little bit of both? Expect to learn that low mood isn't always bad. We discover what the smoke detector principle is. We ask what the purpose of human emotion is. We also discuss whether society is suffering from more mental health problems today than during our ancestors' time. And expect to hear Professor Nesse's thoughts on stoicism and what his hopes are for the future of psychiatry. You are one of the fathers of a field of psychiatry called evolutionary psychiatry and evolutionary medicine. What exactly is evolutionary psychiatry, and how does it inform your approach to treating a patient using psychiatry?
You know, it sounds like some new kind of radical kind of therapy of some sort, but it's not at all. It's just using the basic science of evolutionary biology to understand our emotions as a foundation for understanding why they go wacky so often, and why so many people feel so much anxiety and depression so much of the time that it's useless. It seems like, you know, whoever designed this system really made a big goof.
A big mistake. It's an interesting one. I've commented before about how every so often, nature seems to make what seems to be a mistake. And I suppose that leads to my next question. What is the purpose behind such a mistake? Do you think there is a purpose, or do you think it just happens?
You know, in the rest of medicine, we recognize that cough is useful. It's unpleasant, but useful. Likewise, fever helps to dampen down infections. And even diarrhea and vomiting and stuff, those are useful responses. If you don't have those, you're liable to die. And I think most people recognize that anxiety can be useful, because if you're in a dangerous situation, you know, it's good to get out of there and avoid that situation in the future. But the key to my work is understanding that instead of asking for what's the function of anxiety or the function of depression, we need to ask, in what situations was it useful in the course of evolution of our species? And for anxiety, that's pretty obvious, isn't it? In dangerous situations where you should get the heck out of there, have shaped a whole bunch of standard reactions, like wishing you could get out of there, and your heart starts pounding, and you start breathing deeply, and you can't think of anything else except getting out of there. Those are all useful things. Plus, it's useful to learn to avoid those situations in the future. If a lion chased you away from that particular watering hole last night, you really shouldn't go there tonight. You know, it's just not very smart.
In May of this year, you wrote a terrific article published in the Journal of World Psychiatry in which you said, low mood is useful, but our mood control systems are vulnerable to malfunction. How is low mood useful? And is this malfunctioning of low mood, is this what gives rise then to depression?
So it's a lot harder to see how low mood can be useful compared to anxiety, right? I mean, we tell each other, yeah, we should always be optimistic and energetic and do things, right? But is that really true? Are there some situations in which it's best to do nothing, just hold back? I imagine sometimes my ancestors living on an island in the coast of Norway, who were very enthusiastic in February and said, oh, there must be plants to gather out there. I know I can catch something. I'm hungry. Those who were very enthusiastic and optimistic never came home again, which might have a clue about why tendencies towards low mood might be very useful in that situation. Of course, most of us aren't foraging for food in the middle of the winter these days. Most of us are trying to get a job, trying to get a date, or trying to do things that are useful for our group, you know? How does depression have to do with that? Well, it turns out that we spend most of our lives pursuing various goals. Helping people or helping our kids or making a living or something. And it's always trouble, right? Because everybody else is pursuing similar goals and they want similar kinds of things. And as a result, our life is really, you can analyze life as a whole bunch of glorious failures because we never get everything that we want. So how do we decide when to pull back effort from something we're trying to do? In my job, treating people with anxiety disorders at the University of Michigan, I saw so many people who were extremely ambitious and somewhat successful, but some kids were trying to get into medical school for the fifth time and they were depressed. Well, guess what? The whole purpose of low mood, ordinary low mood, is to stop you from doing things that are just wasting energy and encourage you to turn your efforts in a more productive direction. On the other hand, there's a lot of times when it's not something you can quit, like trying to get into school, it's something like trying to get your kid off drugs, or trying to get yourself to stop drinking, or trying to help your spouse with cancer. Life is hard and you can't give up these things, but the essence of how low mood escalates into depression, normal low mood, is that we often are trapped pursuing unreachable goals. And if you keep trying to do something that's unreachable, perhaps for very good reasons, that ordinary low mood that helps people cope with ordinary kinds of situations just escalates and escalates into really serious depression. I should emphasize before I say another word, Matthew, this does not mean that explains all depression. About half of my patients, I don't find any indication of this kind of situation in a person's life. Some people just have the same genes as their grandmother who committed suicide and their father who had depression his whole life, or they have depression from drinking, or they have depression because of the drugs they're taking, or because of inflammation. So this is not a one cure all kind of thing, but there is a good evolutionary reason why the capacity for low mood exists. And that is crucial for talking with patients and for understanding our own lives.
Is our quest for happiness just a distraction, do you think? When really, if we just knew how to cope better with life and its trials and tribulations, we would be an awful lot more contented with what we have and less inclined to yearn for that utopian state of happiness.
But one of my favorite book titles is about Buddhism and evolution. And the title is How to Want What You Have. Isn't that lovely? But there are good evolutionary reasons why we can't just relax, because we've all been shaped like all other organisms to do things, that get resources and maximize reproduction. That's just how it works. And so if you look at all of philosophy, every philosophy talks about how to deal with desire. And for Buddhism, managing desire is at the center of everything and recognizing that you just can't get what you want. And every school of philosophy has a different solution. Some say, go for it. Those are the hedonists. And others say, grit your teeth and just put up with it. Those are the Stoics. And then the Epicureans kind of are in between. And they say, well, accept pleasure and success when it comes, but don't take anything all that seriously. I like the existential approach instead, which points out that striving for happiness often doesn't get you happiness. And in fact, the most meaningful lives are those that pursue meaning and friendships and and things like that, instead of, you know, money, sex, power, and acclaim. And I don't think most successful lives are by people who are trying to do things that feel meaningful to them. And often those things are often beneficial to society as well. So it's pretty wonderful that not everybody is trying to be the greatest in the world at everything, that so many people are able to take satisfaction in things that they do.
Well, you spoke about several different philosophies there. You mentioned the Stoics, and they were famous for controlling or suppressing their emotions. Can we talk about human emotions, which I know that you've said the psychiatry books traditionally ignored? What is the significance of human emotions, and how have human emotions been shaped by evolution?
I so appreciate that question, because I had been a professor in the psychiatry department for about 10 years when I realized I was treating emotions full time, and I had no idea what they were or why they existed. So I looked in my 1,000-page psychiatry book, and it had one half of one page about emotions. I thought, well, that's not very good. If you look at heart disease, you know, you get, you know, 100 pages about how the heart works and how to understand it before you understand heart failure. In psychiatry, we treat emotions without any knowledge about what emotions are and why they exist and how to regulate. So I dove in. And I spent a whole year just reading everything about emotions. And at the end of that, I was experiencing emotions. I was experiencing frustration mainly and boredom, because all the articles were about how many emotions are there? Let's fight 5, 10, 15, 20. And other people said, well, maybe emotions are separate things. And other people said, no, they're all dimensions. So I sat myself down and said, well, neither do we want to keep arguing about this for another 100 years. But an evolutionary approach, I think, offers a real solution. I wrote an article in 1990 called Evolutionary Explanations of Emotions, which has proved very popular. And the essence is very simple. It is that every emotion is a special suite of changes in the body and the mind that's useful in a certain situation that's recurred over the history of our species. So if you're in a situation where there's some wild animal snarling at you from just a few feet away, and you have the emotion of, oh, beautiful. People who had that emotion are not very long for this world. People who instead didn't think about anything but had heart pumping and muscles tight and running away, that's called a panic attack, by the way. Those people survived and their genes passed on. So most of us have a capacity for having panic attacks in life-threatening danger, and that's a good thing, except when you have them in the grocery store.
How can people reframe then how they view panic attacks when they have one in that circumstance, in the grocery store, as you say?
So that's one of the most practical applications. When I first began treating people with panic disorder, I explained to them, this is a mental disorder, you know, it's not your fault, and we can help you with medications and behavior therapy. And they consistently said, it feels to me like it's my heart, doctor. Can you refer me to a cardiologist? And so gradually, I took a systematic evolutionary view, and I started framing it for my patients in terms of what it's for. And then I began telling my patients, you know what? You're having emergency responses that are false alarms. It's just like the smoke detector going off when there's not really a fire, there's just burnt toast. But your inner mind doesn't know that. And so you feel terrible and you get the sweating, your heart starts pounding. All those things would be useful if you were in a life-threatening emergency. But for you, it's a false alarm. And by the way, it's fortunate that you have the capacity for that. There are other people who never experience enough anxiety, and that could be a fatal disorder. Yours is just miserable. And then I explained to them how, in fact, we can use this understanding of anxiety to appropriately apply psychotherapy and behavior therapy and medications to get them over their problem. It really helps people a lot. In fact, about a quarter of people I talked with, I gave them the explanation for what a panic attack is. And they said, oh, so I'm not going to die of a heart attack. It's not a stroke. It's not epilepsy. I'm just not going to worry about it anymore. And that was all they needed.
How much of mental health conditions like anxiety and depression, how much of that would be inherited, and then how much of it would be learned or acquired through nurture throughout somebody's lifetime?
Yeah, that's a classic question. And for everybody, both apply. There was a very famous psychiatrist who started the Institute for Psychiatry at the Maudsley in London. And about 100 years ago, he did a series He kept records on all of his patients and asked himself, is this caused by the person's situation or by their genes or by some combination? And you know the answer already. It was about a third. And that's been my experience as well. But these things interact. So, you know, trying to say you have a genetic problem or you have a life problem, usually what you find is that people who are sensitive, that is, who have a tendency to anxiety and to rumination and negative thoughts, when those people get in a bad situation, they're more prone to have serious problems than some other people. But on the other hand, one of the wonderful perspectives that an evolution offers is that those people who are sensitive have advantages as well as disadvantages. I mean, so many people think I'm a bad, defective person because I have so much anxiety. No, you have advantages as well as disadvantages. And those people who don't have enough anxiety, especially in social situations, can be really obnoxious.
Talking about that term sensitivity in a slightly different context, why are people so sensitive to what other people think about them? Mm-hmm. Is it because they want to be accepted by the group because there's an increased chance or potential to survive if you're part of a tribe and you don't want to be shunned or isolated from that tribe, which might lead to your early demise?
So I've treated hundreds of people with social phobias, some so bad that they can't leave their house. It's just terrible. But everybody, most everybody, is kind of nervous when they, you know, talk in front of a group or when they get on a podcast. You know, if you say something wrong, it could be pretty bad. And we want to impress people. We want people to like us. But why? Early in my career, it was the I'm okay, you're okay. We shouldn't all be so sensitive, period. It's become very clear as you live someone, as you talk with people, that it's a good thing that we're sensitive. Because that's what makes us want to try very hard to do things that other people will appreciate. Now we have to ask evolutionary reasons for that. And that gets quite deep. There's a whole chapter in that in my book about good reasons for bad feelings, about how we got these capacities for genuine love and morality. And it's not so simple. This is a big debate going back in evolutionary theory. But the answer, I think, is that individuals who are preferred by others as partners, social partners, as well as sexual partners, they get big advantages because they get better partners, because everybody chooses the best partners they can get, or the best employees they can get, or the best bosses they can get, or whatever. So we're all constantly assessing each other to see if this other person can be useful for us and loyal and kind and empathic. And guess what? That means that natural selection shapes these traits for caring a lot about what other people think about us. And it's a wonderful thing, but boy, does it cause a lot of misery too, because so many people lie in bed at night wondering if they just said the wrong thing, or they start planning a day ahead of time about what they're going to say when they call and put in a grocery order. It can be really paralyzing.
You've been working in this field for many years. Do you think we're seeing more mental health issues today than we did, for example, 20 or even 30 years ago? Or is it just more part of the discussion now than it was back then?
That's a well-phrased question. The formal studies do not show gigantic increases in rates of disorder. Ronald Kessler, one of the leaders of the world in epidemiological studies in psychiatry, did a study just before COVID and during COVID. And all the news media were full of these dire stories about the psychiatric epidemics caused by COVID. Yeah, there are lots of us who are miserable because we couldn't go places and do things, and anxious because we feared dying and things like that. But if you actually went door to door to a random sample and asked standard questions, there wasn't much evidence of giant increases in serious anxiety and depression. Whether or not those kinds of problems are more common in modern societies than other societies is a different question. We don't have good answers to that because we don't have all that good data. And I think we should keep an open mind, because social media makes everybody else's life seem so great, makes all of us feel like we're kind of inadequate and we should try harder and the like. So I think they're good questions here, hard to answer though.
I'm interested to hear if there are any current research trends or emerging areas of interest in the field of evolutionary psychiatry that maybe excite you perhaps.
You know, there are all kinds of them. In Ireland there, Henry O'Connell is a wonderful psychiatrist who's created a special interest group in the Irish College of Psychiatry. And I'm sure he'd have a lot to say about this. He's also written several very interesting books about practical applications of evolutionary thinking. I bet you'd like talking with him and people would like hearing from him. In London, the Royal College of Psychiatrists now has 2,000 members in their evolutionary psychiatry group. And there are, I think, about 10 books about evolution and psychiatry. I've been delighted and feel good about the fact that mine, called Good Reasons and Bad Feelings, has been read by so many people, and I keep getting notes from people saying it really helped me. But it's not a self-help book. It's really trying to provide a foundation for how we can use evolution to better understand normal emotions in order to better understand abnormal emotions and other things like eating disorders and OCD and schizophrenia and autism. We probably can't go into those today, but we need to ask the evolutionary questions about why the genes for those disorders persist. It's not because the disorders are useful. The most serious mistake you can make in evolutionary psychiatry is to suggest that some serious disorder exists because it's useful. That's a mistake. On the other hand, the systems that make us vulnerable are there for good reasons. So we could talk more about why natural selection left us vulnerable to all of these problems.
Well, just on that, as far as autism and, for example, ADHD are concerned, there seems to be a huge increase in people being diagnosed with these conditions. Yes. Again, is this just as a consequence of people looking for those conditions and then diagnosing them as a result of people presenting with medical professionals like yourself? Or has there been an uptick in the incidence of ADHD and autism, which wasn't being diagnosed in previous decades?
These are very good questions. And part of my work is epidemiology, so I keep close track of them. And I talk with many epidemiologists. And I don't think we have solid answers. For autism, it appears there may well be a real increase. But it's so hard to tell because the standards for diagnosis are changing and how people present their symptoms is changing, and people don't hide their symptoms the way they used to. For ADHD also, it's pretty clear that those kind of symptoms didn't cause nearly so much problem for hunter-gatherers wandering around trying to gather food and the like than compared with putting kids in classrooms and asking them to try to sit still. But could it be that this really is what we used to call minimal brain damage and causing lack of attention and consistency? Could be. I mean, there's some studies showing that people who grew up on the shores of Lake Michigan here in the United States, who ate more than 3 meals of fish in a month, were more likely to have ADHD. Hard to control those kind of studies. But all of these things are objects of current research, and it's so frustrating we don't have simple, clear answers.
Would you have any in particular advice or any pillars of advice, for example, for people who are listening in today who should be doing particular things or not doing particular things in order to preserve their mental health? You mentioned social media and access to social media already. I'm presuming you would suggest to people, particularly if they suffer from either anxiety and or depression, that they desist from engaging with social media because it can have a negative effect on their mental health.
You know, one of the biggest generalizations from evolutionary psychiatry is that generalizations are not very useful. I think, you know, an evolutionary view means we really should be trying to understand each individual as an individual. What does this person value? What are they trying to do? How is it going? What strategies that are using? What do they hope for? What do they fear? Because people are so different. I mean, some people mainly want to be good, and other people want to be rich, and other people want to take good care of their kids, and other people want to do all those things and be healthy until they're 105. So we really need to try to understand people in the context of their own individual lives and their cultures, and try to not make too grand generalizations. I mean, so many people who talk about emotions and psychiatry and psychology have some solution for people, whether it's, you know, psilocybin or meditation or, you know, decreasing your goals or going for your goals or something. I wish I had a simple solution that would be so helpful to people. I feel bad that I don't, except to say that, you know, every life is individual, and what makes the most difference for most of us are our friends and loved ones and the like, and trying to take good care of them and help be close to them is really the foundation, along with trying to do things that can be done. Pursuing reachable goals, I think, is something that's crucial for successful living without too much unhappiness.
So you're promoting the bespoke approach, really, to maintaining your mental health.
And just respect for individuals in general, instead of trying to tell everybody to do the same thing. This also means it's very hard to practice these kinds of things clinically. And because if you just make a diagnosis and give the treatment that's good for that diagnosis, that's really quite crude. In the rest of medicine, people try to figure out why this person got pneumonia and do something about it, or why this person has heart failure. I think in psychiatry, we should be doing more and more of that. But there's so many people who have so many problems that the specialized skills of psychiatrists probably have to be spread around to many, many people in short intervals so that other people can talk with people about their problems. This is a problem I don't know how to solve, but I went into the field wanting to have, you know, individual treatment relationships with individual people. And by the time my career treating people finished, there really wasn't time for that, and it was too expensive.
You mentioned psilocybin there. I interviewed somebody recently who spoke at length about psilocybin. I'm just interested to hear your own view of that emerging field, really, in the area of psychology and psychiatry.
I haven't looked into the details, but one of my former students, Eiko Fried, from Amsterdam, has just written an article pointing out that the quality of the studies showing usefulness for those kinds of interventions is very poor. It's very hard to tell whether the benefits come directly from the medication or from the setting and the experience or from the expectation kinds of effects. Other studies are being done, but it's very, very hard to figure out how things work. He deserves credit for standing up and saying we really should be careful instead of just assuming this is a new cure that will be good for so many people.
That's interesting, because there seems to be a tidal wave of interest in promoting psilocybin as a method of for treating depression.
Did you read about the pilot just last week who was on psilocybin to try to help his mental problems? And because he was a pilot, he was allowed in the cockpit with the other pilots of a commercial plane. In the middle of this, he grabbed the fire extinguishers for both engines and tried to shut down the plane. And the other pilots fortunately saw him quickly and grabbed his hands away. And later he explained the next day, he said, I was in a psychedelic delusional state. I thought that I was in a dream, and that the only way to get out of the dream would be to crash the plane. This is kind of serious stuff.
Wow. And this was after he had had exposure to psilocybin.
I mean, so he was on the psilocybin when he was in that state in the plane. It was the next day when he came out of it that he explained why he did what he did. He said he was very sorry, but that's not quite enough when you try to crash a plane full of people.
Tell me, do you think advancements in genomics and neuroscience will contribute to our understanding of the evolutionary basis of mental health going forward?
Hugely. Back when the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual came into being, just as I started my career, we all thought that we would soon have specific genetic and neuroscience disorders, and we'd redo our diagnostic categories based on that. And it's been such a desperate disappointment that we have not found any specific common genes that cause these illnesses. We haven't found specific spots in the brain or neurotransmitters that are responsible. It seems like most of these disorders are products of very incredibly complicated interactions of many, many genes and many, many places in the brain. And an evolutionary framework helps us to look at these things as system failures in terms of how the normal system works, instead of hoping that we're just going to find one specific spot or one specific brain abnormality. On the other hand, I sure hope we can find specific brain abnormalities. It would be just wonderful. It would lead to new cures. And so we've got to keep trying. But I'd like to encourage us to, you know, to step back and try to ask, like the rest of medicine does, how does the system work in the first place? And why is it vulnerable to failure?
Really, really interesting discussion. I could talk to you at length for hours, but alas, our time has come to an end. Professor Nesse, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
People who are interested can easily find my website, where there's lots of things to read for free and lots of other videos. And I'll put a link to this one up on the website as well when it's ready. Great talking to you.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, thank you for listening to this episode of the Happy Habit Podcast. If you're enjoying listening to the series and you want to support the work that I'm doing here, please like, subscribe, share with people you know, people, friends and family, and work colleagues. And if you have the time, just take 2 seconds to leave the podcast a thumbs up or a positive review, because it helps spread the message far and wide. Until next time, stay happy.